Welcome to Vaudeville. I'm here with a guest. He has been here before. And would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name's Marco Garcia. Student at the University of Houston.
Yeah, Marco is a friend of mine. And what are we going to talk about today, Marco?
So today we're going to be talking about some of our favorite films of the past year, 2022.
Yes. So I'm so excited. I'm ready to dive in. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. So one of my personal favorite movie this year was Everything Everywhere All at Once, directed by the Daniels. And what are your thoughts on it? How do you feel?
So I think it's pretty fair to say for me personally that it was probably one of the best like theater experiences I've ever had. It sort of takes you like on this roller coaster. It feels like it takes you through like a lot of human emotion, even fear of like, so like the philosophical issues it brings up. But it was just sort of like this emotional like roller coaster for me, but I loved it. And it was one of my favorite theater experiences because it was obviously affecting all of the people in the theater the same way. Like we would, you know, and we would laugh at the same parts. We'd be like silent, you know, at specific parts. You could tell it had a grip on like everyone in the theater. And so it turned into like this collective experience for me, which was really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. I think the only other type of movies that tend to get people in that space is like Marvel movies.
Yeah, it was kind of like that.
Yeah, and well, to be honest, it actually was like everyone laughed at certain parts and some parts were funny. People were like, you know, having like intense emotions. It wasn't like, oh, you know, the ratio of emotion. Like the emotions were intense. Like sometimes you get very pissed at certain people and then sometimes like you are sad. I think one of the funniest parts, oh my God, I will never forget when the guy was fighting and they were like, he jumped up and fell on that award, the most auditor award. I like the whole
that scene. Yeah,
that scene was hilarious. Oh my God.
I think what's great about that scene is that it's like there's a build up to it. So mm-hmm. like it before we even get to that part, like the film's already established, right? That like in order to jump between universes, you have to do like this absurd thing, right? That no one expects you to do. And so that there's already that sort of rule, like that's been like sort of established in the universe. But then there's also like, you saw the award, like at the very beginning of the film, right? And you think it's just so this sort of comedy thing. And so when those two things just come together, it's hilarious. But, and it's probably one of my favorite action scenes in a long time.
It is.
Like, aside from the, like, obviously about the trophy thing, like the choreography is amazing and like the, like not to get like technical, but like the camera work is sort of like working with the editing is sort of pushes like the momentum in a way that you don't usually see in a lot of other action movies. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's just very good like action aside from like the storytelling stuff about the trophy.
I agree. It's one of my favorite. I think most of my favorite is the one with forgot her name, the girl, the daughter, where she changes like different characters all at once, and then she's like slumbering mm-hmm. with the police guy, and she's like dancing the this, and then she I love that scene. That's like one of my favorite scenes. I remember like coming out from theater, and I was like asking my friends, because I went with my friends, how they felt about it, and they were like, it felt like a lot. Certain people, you know, I guess to say me, I was like, I feel like I'm the only one who was excited about this. I realized, like, even amazing films for people. Some people will not be amazing for others, obviously. Everyone has their preferences, but like to me it didn't move so fast as like people like my friends talked about. So I don't really know. I guess in a sense, one of them was saying that they couldn't relate to it in any way. And I was like, dang, I relate so much to it. Like the whole idea of like generational traumas being passed down.
Yeah. I feel like that's a big part of it. And I think I feel like if you don't have like those certain like I guess like experiences, then it's sort of you're not going to relate to it as easily as other people. So like if you know, if you're if you have like that same, if you come from that same background as the main characters do, right?
Yeah.
And of having a certain type of like a parent that's very like overbearing and you know watches over your every decision and wants you to be a certain thing, right? I
Yeah.
mean, I think there's some overlap. I think there's some like universal things, unfortunately, about that situation, but I feel like there are certain people from certain backgrounds that you know have that experience. But I mean, like it all, it's also I think one of the reasons that it's also great too is like the philosophical issues it touches on. Like it's obviously about like that sort of generational trauma
Yeah.
that we see, right? But you also have like like it doesn't just stop there. It like sort of keeps going, and it talks about like the fact that the universe is basically like this void, right, that doesn't care that you exist. And I mean, I sort of have like a theory actually about, I mean, I've read some of the stuff that like or listened to some of the stuff that the Daniels, the directors have said about like what inspired the film, but just coming from like a philosophical background is just, like it's I couldn't help but like noticing that like it goes through like issues of like existentialism, absurdism, and even if you've read like French existentialism, there's like Camus' idea of like rebellion, which is sort of his response to like the fact that like nothing matters.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I feel like you see that sort of path like in the film, but I don't know, that's sort of like a theory I have, but I'm sure there's like a lot of different other things that are going on in the film that related to that.
I mean, the whole nothing bagel, it's definitely because at the end of the day, when Joy, and I remembered her, talks to her mom, like even when she is normal Joy, not like any other of the Joy, she talks about like how it doesn't matter, everything matters, and the mother is trying to save her from that, existentialism, in the end, where she's just trying to show that things do matter, because she feels like if, the whole idea is that, if Joy falls into this existentialism, then that's the end of her. She goes into the nothing bagel and nothing matters anymore to the world. And even like the whole idea of like them, even the like hitting on your theory, the characters, the different characters that they portray, especially the rock. The whole idea was like, oh, it's just a rock. Like, who cares? It's nothing, like, no one cares about a freaking rock. A rock doesn't have like a whole life, like it doesn't move, nothing goes, like, nothing matters to a rock. But then they're showing, in that sense, with the characters and just with Joy, especially, like, trying to make this whole. It's making the argument for existentialism, but also bringing that family, well, moving out of it a bit, kind of like saying, oh, yeah, it does matter. There are things that matter in life. By the end of the day, even when she shows, because she was like, I'm going to show you, when she goes into the couch and then things start changing for her, it's kind of. It is, I do agree with that in terms of like existentialism. It is one of the themes. It's like trauma, existentialism. There are like many pillars that make up this movie. It's so multifaceted and like it doesn't just, it touches so many parts of it, both visually and like story, true narrative structure. Well, speaking of visually, it's so pretty. That's what I'm saying.
It is, yeah.
It's a beautiful movie.
I think it's like a really good example of like the idea that you don't need like millions of dollars to make your film look like amazing. Like if you look at the behind the scenes stuff and everything, like so like let's the so whenever they time whenever they jump between universes, you sort of see like this blur like happen around the character, and to sort of like indicate that that she's travel they're traveling through a different to a different universe. And like that effect is like is literally like just the character like sitting in a chair, and like they're actually like there's like a just two screens around her around the character, and they literally just show like a blur on the screen, and so it's this very like almost practical. I mean, it's not practical, but it's you're not doing a lot like to really get that effect. It's really more in the editing and like the way you put the camera and things like that. And even yeah, like just but yeah, it's an amazing like visually like it's an amazing film like because of I think because of the editing like that too.
I do agree. I love that every part of the main character's journey or version of herself, there is a change in color. When she is, quote unquote, I think it's in Korea or going to the country, and she's like there with her husband or father-in-law. She chose the third part. She didn't choose to marry. It's so green, like it's so somewhat saying, you know, in a sense of like a growth away from the norm in which she took a part in which she took. The spaghetti, the hot dog hands. Which, oh my god, this that scene was oh my god, it was great. There's this play with a mixture of red and yellows. It's just like everything, the colors, the choices, everything has a meaning in which like you're seeing the main character's journey in those places too, and you even have like feelings for said character even though we don't have too much time to spend with her as that person. I remember like feeling so bad for the auditor lady who was her love interest in the hot dog hands scene, and that scene wasn't long obviously, but you could feel the emotion with each story that is being told, and I just like it didn't have to have a whole like all of it encompasses to be like a one story, but like it's like where stories of their own, and it's just so beautiful. I don't know, the movie was great. It was amazing.
I think you touched on one of the other things that I really loved about it, which is that in a sort of, I think like if you're making like this movie, like a movie where you jump between universes or you show different universes, it's there's a danger in like just narratively, like how do you even like, it's already enough that you have to tell one story in a film, right? You know, you have your hands full with that, and so like how do you get an audience to not only you know, become engaged in these other universes, but how do you pull that off, right? Like how do those things fit into the overall narrative of the main story? And it's I mean, yeah, like you just explained it, like you don't, I would be interested in seeing like how much screen time each of the other universes has, because they like they feel like they each like had enough of screen time. But like for example, the universe in which he's the chef, right? The main character is the chef.
Yeah.
That's probably my favorite universe, I think. But it's literally like if you go back and like watch the film, that universe, we spent time in that universe for maybe like a few hours, like in relative to their time. But you get it, like it's still all emotionally like powerful. That's just one of the other things I loved about it, is that it makes you engaged in all of these other storylines that you, like, and again, going back to like all of these emotions that you feel like during the film. It's just like fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. You literally went to the idea of like story structure with the universes and the story structure of the film in general. Like, I loved the husband, like the husband, every universe of the husband was just,
such a great actor.
Yeah,
I mean, everyone was acting incredibly in this film, but I don't know why his like just was just like probably my favorite one. Maybe I think it's because there was such a disparity between like, or like a such a link, like a gap between his versions of himself, because I think like the daughter and even the main character, they sort of had their versions of their characters weren't like super different, I think. Like I mean, maybe the one with for Michelle Yeoh's character, like her being a famous movie star and herself as this owner of the laundromat, like those, that's sort of different. But I feel like in his, for the guy, right, like it's like he switches the, like he flips a switch and he's like a completely different character, and like you actually see it. And I don't know, I think that's one of the powerful things about it.
Yeah, I was about to say that, in which like even in the beginning you see him be two different people, and like that's why I think you think that his acting is amazing, because like we rarely see like someone like, yes, Joy changes a lot. But in the beginning, like, we see, he's the first character we are introduced into, like, the whole idea of, like, there's a multiverse. I think, like, one of the very, like, prominent scenes for me was the one where she becomes a star and he also becomes a star in his own right. And, like, he's talking to her and talking about, like, like, imagine what would have been if, like, we ended up together. I was like, dang. Like, I love this scene. Like, the scene was so, like, obviously emotionally driven and so beautiful. But
I think one of the best lines in that movie, and probably one of the best lines in the film, is something like, you know, when she's telling him what, because she has access to the other universe, she knows, like, mm-hmm. that they became, like, this married couple, right? And he says something like, well, I would have liked to have done, like, the taxes with you or the laundry with you or something like that. Like, that would have been okay, right? Like, even if our lives are miserable, that would have been a good life for me. And so it's, like just adding, like, more to the character and to his performance is so great. But, yeah, that whole, and that scene, like, just made me, like, go see, like In the Mood for Love and like Chungking Express. I was like, I want to know where these references came from, and it was that scene was one of the best ones.
I do agree. It got a lot of inspiration, yes, from Wong Kar Wai, that particular scene, Meant to Be, Not Meant. And towards the end, like, when the final fight is just like, his character was amazing. It's like, from start to finish. I think all of them, their characters were amazing from start to finish. But I just know, like you said, his character was something very, I guess, for me, very prominent. Like, I was like, oh, wow, that's great acting and just great in general. But yeah, I personally, in terms of like, how many stars out of five would you give Everything, Everywhere, All at Once?
I think I rarely give like 5 stars, but like I think it's I and again, like, I think I have to watch it more times, but it is probably my favorite film, like, of the year, like, so far. And I think, I don't know, I think I would have to wait maybe a few years before I could tell, like, if it's actually like a favorite film of mine. But yeah, I really loved it. I would just give it definitely like 5 out of 5.
Yeah, me too. Someone said, because now there are so many multiverse movies out there, mostly made by Marvel. I'm not laughing. But it is by far the best multiverse movie ever made to this day. I stand by that. Someone could literally say, but what about Spider-Man? Well, Spider-Man can hold it for a bit. But what about Spider-Man?
Listen, I know we're not supposed to talk about other movies, but that, man, what a disappointment for me for that film.
Which one?
Oh, Spider-Man.
The No Way Home one,
the recent one.
Not watched anything by.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really?
I speaking of Spider-Man, I'm doing Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is also multiverse and amazing.
That's funny that you bring that one up. That one's probably the only other multiverse film that I would like say that's almost on par with this one, because it's what is it called? Into the Spider-Verse, yeah, I think it's what it's called. That one's a great film. That's a great film.
It is. I agree. But Everything Everywhere All at Once is still one of the best multiverse movies. And then Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is second. Close second. Then the rest are fighting for last place. And
for real.
For now. But yes. So now we are moving on a bit. We are moving to something also visually pleasing. French Dispatch. Yeah. We're moving to the French Dispatch. Directed by Wes Anderson, this film came out in 2021, last year. And yeah, what are your thoughts, your feelings, what do you think about The French Dispatch?
So I heard about this film, and I'm a big Wes Anderson fan, so I've like seen a bunch of his films. I think my favorite, like still my favorite of his, is The Grand Budapest Hotel. I love that film. One of the films that really got me into like films, because I think it came out like, man, almost a decade ago, like 2014. I think it was around that time. But anyway, I'm a big Wes Anderson fan, but and so I wanted to check this movie out. And my first impression sort of was that it was very dense, and it was like a lot. Like, it was there are maybe three main stories, right? Like, so there's the artist, and then there's the sort of like revolutionary, like a young revolutionary, Timothy Chalamet. And then there's the last character, which is, I believe, a writer, although there's sort of like these three broad like stories, it was like just visually, like, and in terms of like how the film is structured, it was I felt like it was a lot. Like it was a, like, and I'm still like sort of struggling to know if we're like whether or not that's a good thing or not. Like even on rewatch, it was like you could pause like any frame of that film and just dissect it. And so I think that's where I'm a little, so I guess like to answer your question, I'm a bit like, I think the word is ambivalent. So like, I'm like, I have like positive feelings about it, but I also have like negative feelings about it. I'm sort of conflicted about it, but I think I would recommend it for sure. And I think it's weird to answer. It's like, I know this thing is like a masterpiece, but like, I don't know if it's a favorite of film of mine, you know, like it's weird. How about you?
I told you when we said, oh, we're going to talk about the French Dispatch, I forgot half of what the French Dispatch was about. Like you said, it was a lot. And my brain was like, wait a minute. Whoa. I did watch this movie. I am 100% sure I watched this movie. But why did I forget half of the film? What was my, like, I will say it's a rare thing to not, remember the first half of the film, and then the rest of the film just feels like nothing happened. Like I said, when I went to, I remember the artist, I remember the newspaper was talking about some obituary, and then I remember Timothée Chalamet seeing the revolutionaries, and that's kind of like it. I don't know any, the bicycle scene. It was also something very prominent.
That got me to laugh out loud, yeah.
That was funny. The bicycle scene was my favorite scene in the movie, but it did feel like a lot was happening. We're moving from color to black and white to color to... And I was like, okay, I like it. It's nice, but it feels like this could be broken down into two films and then maybe, you know, I like Wes Anderson movies too. I like The Grand Budapest Hotel. I love The Isle of Dogs. And I love The Fantastic Mr. Fox. Just to name a few.
Mr. Fox is so funny. I love that film. Yeah.
And I understand he's an auteur. He gets so much inspiration from the French New Wave, this one. And he's a modern day auteur. I will say that he's a genius. Now... related to the French Dispatch, I see that genius, you know, sometimes you say when a genius brain is brewing, sometimes it becomes like a lot happening. I felt like a lot was happening and it puts it on us. And I'm like, the viewer is just kind of, like, I feel I have mixed feelings. I don't think most of it is bad. It just, like, it felt a lot. I liked so many scenes of it. It was funny. It was understandable. Usually, like, when I try to introduce certain people into, like, oh, Wes Anderson movies, they're like, oh, it is those movies that, like, people don't understand. And I'm like, well, it is understandable. And the French part is understandable. It's just, like I said, a lot was happening in terms of both plot and visually. And that is coming from someone who just said that everything everywhere all at once was visually not too much. So I don't know. It's mixed feelings too.
You know, it's, I think you touched on something that was like, I think that's really important for this film, is that Wes Anderson, like, he really tries to do something like incredibly hard in this film, which is, he, like, if you've ever read like any sort of magazine, like the New Yorker, right? Like, he basically tried to make a movie out of a magazine like that, and sort of make a film that would be experienced as a magazine, right? So you would have the beginning, you would have like short sort of things at the beginning, sort of like, this is just going back to my experience of like reading the New Yorker, but you usually have like these little sections at the beginning, and then you get into the sort of lengthy articles in the middle, and then the ending is again some sort of like short pieces, like a book review or something like that. And I think, I mean, that's like, just as an experiment, like in film, like that's an awesome idea, like to do, like to try to translate that. Because if you look at every section of the story, like in this film, each part is told by a journalist who was reporting on the story, right? And so you have like, I think it was Tilda Swinton, right? Who was writing the story for the artist.
Artist, yeah.
So you have her sort of narrating that segment of the story, and then you have Frances McDormand, is her name, I think.
Yes, Frances.
Who's doing the Timothée Chalamet sort of revolutionary part, and then you have Jeffrey Wright doing that last part. And I think, like, yeah, just as an experiment in film, I had Like, that's an awesome idea, right? Like, so you're having it's they're basically flashbacks, but they're also reading their piece to you. So I can appreciate that. But I think going back to like what you were saying about like you sort of remember the only the first half of the movie. I think that has to do with like just narratively, I think the first one is probably the best story, the so Benicio del Toro's story with the with his sort of muse that he creates work art out of in prison. Like that's just like compelling, like super compelling, and it was well done, like super well done. But I think, yeah, I think probably the middle part is probably the weakest part for me, and then you kind of lose focus a little bit, and then it comes back together. And I think I like on rewatch, I really liked like the last part about the writer who gets like into prison because he's he I think he's put in jail because he's like he's gay basically. And you know that whole experience, like there are like really awesome parts in the ending too, but yeah, it's just that middle part. And again, like what you were saying too about like all of the stylistic changes that he does, that Wes Anderson does, like it's sort of at first it's really nice, but then it gets like exhausting as the film goes on to me. I don't know, that those are just, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah.
What kind of moving a bit to the visual, which you just talked about, I think because, like, for example, his film, like Grand Budapest Hotel, there's this prominence of one color, which is pink, and the prominence of that.
Yeah.
The same goes for Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is very yellow and red, orange. So my brain is kind of like Wes Anderson, there is this prominent color. This one, a lot, like I said, a lot was happening with the colors. The artist was black and white. The Revolutionary was black and white too, if I remember.
Some
But
parts of it, yeah.
yeah, the beginning part it was, I guess, interesting. And like generally, I'd be like, oh, a move from black and white to color is not a problem generally in films. That could happen anytime or anywhere, whatever. But I think, like I said, you know, because a lot of his films and the way he films is very, a split screen moved left to right kind of camera movement going on. Like I said, now that I think of, wait, now that I talk about it being like a magazine, it's kind of like you're flipping a page, which,
Yeah.
but it's just the style, it's the same style he used for Budapest
Yeah.
Hotel. But to just go with your argument, I could say it's like flipping a page. And like I said, the only prominent one was the artist story, which like I think one of the best stories in the film, like the whole artist and the whole riots in the prison all of a sudden, and then at the end of the day they were like, oh, but then Simone and the artist never spoke to each other anymore. It's like, okay, that's an abrupt end, and now we move on to the next story. So
You know,
it's
there's such a, like, if you want to, I kind of want to talk a little bit about that first story, because it's like there are such, like, there's a genius thing that Anderson does in that part where, so the artist, right, like he spends he spends his whole life basically in prison, right, because he starts out as this young man and then he grows into the Benicio del Toro, right.
Yeah.
But like the way he shows that is fascinating. Like, and I've never seen it in film, right? Where I don't know if you remember this, but the young version of him is sort of sitting in this chair, like, and it's in black and white. And instead of like cutting to a different scene and then now him being older or anything like that, his older self literally walks into the room,
Yeah.
and he tells him, he like asks him to get up or something like that, and he gets up. And there's not like a word spoken, right? And so they literally unseat each other, right? And there's this nice moment where like the older version like pats him on the head, and then the younger version like puts his whatever he was wearing around his, I think it's like a necklace, like he puts it on his older self. And it's just sort of like this, like there's so many ways to show like the age transition, but that was such like a, like almost like a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
And it sort of like makes you think about like how you yourself like grow as a person, and like your relationship. I know this is like philosophical, like way too philosophical, but like it made me think of like, you know, how your younger self fears like sort of getting older, and like how your older self is sort of coming in and like replacing that, I don't know, and like how we lose our younger self. And it's just like, I don't know if that's what he meant by doing that, but it was such a, like a touching moment that I liked.
I kind of, when I was watching it, I kind of read it as, you know, like how we, when, like now we're older, we're like, oh, if I talk to my younger self, this is what I'll tell him. But like in a sense, with Anderson, that scene was more or less like the older person and the young person being like, we're still in this shit. We're still in jail. Oh,
That's also a very good reading of it.
okay. Because it's just like there's no communication, there's no excitement, or you know, you're just like, oh well,
Yeah.
same routine. And so I that's an interesting interaction, because like you know, there's so many, like you mentioned, there's so many films, and like you talked about the transition to that, but there are also so many films that are like, oh, I wait, no, with storylines like, oh, if I could talk to my former self, this is how I'll speak to them, or this is like a weird blurring of like older and former selves, but never like this, never in that interaction of the older and younger. And I kind of read it like that. But I will, I'm gonna come back to Bicycle Scene because I love that scene so much. In which, like, you know, Owen Wilson is
Oh,
like,
I think I know what you're going to talk about, actually.
whoa.
But there's a, I mean, if it's not it, you can definitely jump back in. But there's an amazing like scene of so like what Owen Wilson is doing in that scene is he's sort of providing a snapshot for the reader of what the city is like in Nui, I think is the name of the city. And there's literally a scene where they just put the camera like on a street. And he's saying like it just comes alive out of nowhere, right? Like he's narrating and saying that, and it does that, right? Like the city, like you see the city how it wakes up and like how different buildings start moving with different people, and like you see people starting their day and like people coming in and out of the scene, and it's just like this very like brilliant thing that he does in that first scene. But I don't know if that's what you're gonna talk about, but that was another great part of the movie.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that actually. And also, I don't know, I'm now reading in so much into your whole magazine theory, because I actually read magazines too. And like, you know, the whole idea of like something like the New Yorker, they're like, about town, our about town is one of the columns in the New Yorker, where they talk about New York, what is hip, what is going on, like a snapshot of New York. And like, as he rides his bicycle around, we're kind of seeing that in a weird portraity things, like you open the magazine, this is the picture of the city you're seeing, and everything's like you said coming alive as he's going about and he's describing it. And I'm just like now you mentioned the magazine theory, I'm just like, maybe you're right. maybe your theory is right in that sense. Well, yeah, that bicycle scene was one hilarious. Number two, I think one time he kind of goes down something and then comes up. If I'm remembering
There was
correctly.
he was sort of talking about the traffic and like the pollution of the traffic, and then he doesn't see that there's like a stairway going down into the ground, and he just falls in there.
That was great. And now we're going to slowly move to the narrative structure of the film, which Wes Anderson and Turner doesn't follow the whole three-act structure because he's a man of his own will. And it comes to his own thing, so he makes his own structure most times. That's my own theory, though. You could have a different idea on that. But like the story structure, the narrative structure, does he pay off at the end? Like you said, we spoke about Everything Everywhere All at Once, where we talked about the fight scene with the award. It's something like this payoff, like this an introduction and there's a payoff. Is there something you see similar in The French Dispatch?
I think you have to talk about like, and it would be hard again to like sort of talk about like, you know, like what is the resolution of the conflict by the end of the film, right? Because there's, like you said, there's no like rising action and a climax and then, you know, like that sort of stuff. Because it's sort of like vignettes, right? There are like glimpses of these different parts of France, of this city in France, which is like a fictional city, by the way. It's not real. I think if there was one payoff that if you were trying to look for something like that would sort of tie everything together, it's probably related to like Bill Murray's character. And because I mean, the film starts with his death, right? And it's the fact that they're writing these stories is because he, I think it was like in his will that there would be the magazine would die with him, basically. So he says, or it's in his will when they're reading it, that they're gonna stop making this magazine whenever he dies. And so this is sort of like a farewell issue, I guess. And I think, I mean, that there's, yeah, like, so if there's a payoff, it's like being able to like see how I guess he's like an editor or something, of how this person was able to, change the lives of, I guess, these like different journalists, and like the stories he was able to tell, I guess. I hadn't ever really thought of that question, but again, like on rewatch, like you sort of see his presence a little bit in each of the stories. Like, for example, in the last one, he's the one who gives Jeffrey Wright's character a job at the magazine, right? And he's in prison, and there's like a funny scene where Jeffrey Wright's character is like sitting in prison or in the jail, and Bill Murray's there sitting with him, and he's like, he tells the policeman not to come to them because he's like conducting a job interview with him. But
Yeah.
it's like this sort of like absurd thing. But and he's actually, he's the one who gives him like an opportunity to write about, I guess, like to give him a chance at being a writer, right? Because he's like this aspiring like actor or writer. And of course he's like this fantastic like writer, the Jeffrey Wright's character. And I love that whole thing of like how he's like he has like a memory of every word he writes. So he can recall like whole paragraphs of his articles, and so he's literally the guy who's interviewing him in that final story. He's literally just retelling his article to him because he knows it by memory. So he's obviously a great writer, but yeah, that whole scene I think is like it sort of sets up the payoff in the obituary, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, I guess, like you said, narratively, it's a lot. There's so much happening, so many stories. But narratively, I think with each story, there is the whole structure with each one. I don't know, it's like little vignettes coming and making, like a heart EPB or whatever, EKG wave thing going on for each story, and it's not really going on for the general story, but I guess it is, because at the end of the day, it's all for, in a sense, like Bill Murray, like the final paper thing happening for them. And so I agree in that sense. But I like going back to what I was saying in terms of him being an auteur and like more or less bringing back like very 60s film styles to his work, and in terms of like narrative structure, like I will more or less fixate on like something like the French New Wave, where like the narrative structure wasn't like the same three act structure. Like, look at you recently watched Breathless, which the first watch I was like, oh my God, why am I watching this film? It's leading me nowhere.
Wait, which film?
Breathless, Jean-Luc Godard, I think it was on your list.
That's, it's funny that you say that because it's literally like what probably one of my favorite films like in a long time. And I
Yeah.
can't explain it why. And like you said, it has no, I mean, there is something that happens at the end, by the end, right? Like it happens to the main character and there's sort of resolution there. But yeah, a lot of Godard's films are like that. Like they're in a similar way, like a bunch of vignettes, right? Like, I mean, they're all about the same character, right?
Yeah.
But there's no like explicit thread between each of them. Yeah, but they each provide a sort of like, and it's sort of that's what's sort of different from French Dispatch, I think, is that they each provide like a different side of that character a little bit. Like they put them in different situations, and so you get to see this character from a from like. Like the complexity of the character, like it sort of it adds as the film goes on, I guess. But I don't know, that's just one theory about like why he chooses to make films that way. But anyway, I definitely saw like a lot of that influence in the middle part, right? Like
Yeah.
the part with the Timothée Chalamet.
I So in a sense, like, we're talking about the character, like, obviously Bill Murray is a prominent character in the film, but like the main character being, I personally think, like, going with your theory, is the magazine itself, in that sense.
Yeah, that's
so
a good
at
idea.
End of the day, even if you say, oh yes, it's very quite different from French Way, where we see like a development in the character, with all those vignettes happening, or in French Dispatch, the character does, well, if you consider the character the magazine, the beginning part introduces it, the middle part is, not, like you said, not as strong, and then the final part really ends it, and it's just like a whole, like, really, I won't say who reads the middle part of the magazine, because, like, when people scroll through, it's the beginning part that is very interesting, and the middle part is like, oh my god, and then the end is something else, or wherever perfumes are, it's all people in search for perfumes, samples. But I do believe maybe if we do consider the main character being the magazine, we might actually see the film in a quite different light, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know, I have to think about that. But, yeah, the, like, I don't know if you sort of want to wrap up a little bit, the French Dispatch. Like, I think one of the final things I could say about it is, like, I've been trying to think about why the middle part doesn't work. And I don't know, I still don't really know why, but I think it's just because of the story itself. It's a bit, I don't know, like, there is a lot of, like, I feel like it sort of confuses the audience member a little bit. Like, so, like, you're telling the story about this guy who's Timothée Chalamet's character, but sprinkled throughout that story is, like, a flashback. So it's, like, a flashback within the flashback, and then there's, like, the switching of the colors, and then, I don't know. I'm curious about what your thoughts about that part is.
Yeah, like I said, I mostly did not remember said parts, but what I remember now, like, because as you talk about it, it comes back slowly, and in a sense, I do feel like, compared to the other part, like, there is consistency in the other stories in terms of visually and story-wise. There is, like, a consistency going on. Even when there is, like, we talk about the young, old meeting the young scene, there is still that story consistently going on for the character. Now, with the middle part, that consistency is not really considered in that sense. Like, you talk about change in color, and then, like, the flashback about the lady he all of a sudden had an affair with, and then all of a sudden she let him go be with somebody, and then it's like,
yeah.
I was like, wait, what's happening?
And then I think I don't know, I'm still conflicted about this, but, like, if you remember, the story is, like, this revolution, right, that we see happen in the city is that it's a bunch of students, right, and they're sort of they have grievances with the school, right, and then it sort of becomes a big thing whenever one of them gets drafted to military service, and then, which is, yeah, that's cool, that's compelling, or not cool, but it's compelling, right, but then, like as the film goes on, like, we get the story, or a play version of the story of what happened, of how they had originated. And so we cut away from the revolutionary stuff back to the military character who was in the military, and it's not actually a scene of him in the military. It's a play of that. That's told years later. And not only is it, and so it's on a stage too. So it's not it literally stops becoming a film. And I felt like I was watching a theater play. And I don't like when movies do that. Whenever it feels like it could be a theater play, like, that's whenever I check out for some reason. If I'm thinking to myself, this could have been this should have been a play. Like, I don't like making that. I don't like when I think that when I'm watching a film, because it's like, oh, well, then why is this a film? You know, like, and I don't know, but, like, again, I don't know if it's a brilliant choice, or it's like this thing that shouldn't be in a film. I don't know. But it makes sense narratively because it's a play. I don't know, but still, like, there's a lot of questions, I guess, in this middle part of the film, which is why I think it affects my overall, like, impression of the film.
This is definitely an aside. Have you all drive my car?
No.
Okay, you should want Drive My Car, or maybe you shouldn't, because it's a whole idea of like play and film being played around in film, which is great. It works in that film, I will tell you. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, and you reminded me too of there's a great movie that I watched. It's called The Lock. It's an A24 film, I think, with Tom Hardy. It's literally him in a car.
Oh, yes. I was like, why does that sound familiar? I know what you're talking about, because I
And
remember.
like for the longest time, I was like, this is the peak cinema, right? And then like as the more I thought about it, I was like, this is not a film, this is a play, right? And like and then obviously whenever I learned more about like when I had like more experience in watching different films,
Yeah.
that's whenever I was like, yeah, I don't think that's a good film actually.
I okay, so like when I was watching it, I was like, this is interesting. This is definitely new. Like, why are we with this man in the car all throughout this film? You know, obviously, some films have emulated that where like something like The Call, which is like you and the call center person, you never see who the center is. You're feeling the emotions, everything's happening at the same time. It kind of worked for that, but I don't know why it did not just work for the Tom Hardy film, because I was just like, when you mentioned it at first, I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, and then you're like, the car, and Tom Hardy's like, oh my god, I do remember it, because we literally spent the whole film with him in the car, and
And it's good. It's a good story.
it is a good story. It's just, I guess, you know, the whole idea of like the brain gets tired when it's just seeing one thing for a long time. Tom
I like when
Hardy.
it, and like this is we're talking about a different film now, but like it's funny because in that film, like the usually you jump from scene to scene in a film, right? Whether it's in the past, in the future, whatever, you're changing the story. But whenever that film wants to change the sort of the scene, whatever, it just shows you the lights of like the highway, and like you're and that way you're sort of like psychically or mentally like tricked into thinking, okay, we've moved past that one part and now we're going to the next part. But I don't know if that makes it a good film, you know. But it's a compelling story. I really enjoyed watching.
I will end the aside by saying that the script must look like hell when reading it, because how do you change int? You're like int, car, knight throughout the whole film. It continued int car, Sin Musu highway, then continued int car light. And I was like, how does
There's
one?
like 100 shots of the dashboard in that film, right?
Okay, so we are back and we're going to talk about Totoro, My Neighbor Totoro by Hayao Miyazaki. And this is a lot older than the other films we talked about. It was made in 1988, so like going back to what I said, Marco, what are your feelings? How do you feel about Totoro? In general, what emotions, thoughts?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's such a like a feel good film. I mean, parts of it are definitely not feel good, but I think what's so powerful about it for me is that it presents you with like something that we really don't see in like films these days, unfortunately, is just a family that you know, despite whatever hardships they're facing, they just like really love each other. And they, even though they get mad at each other or they're upset with each other, like it's never a question of whether like if they love each other. I don't know if that makes sense, but like they're you always know that they're a family, I guess, and that they're like and the film makes you it's an animated film, but it makes you feel like really feel like that they're a family. And not just, you know, obviously for the people that are like obviously related, like the father and his daughters and I guess his wife. But like just the people they live around within their community too, like it's sort of like a simple answer to your question, but like I just really love that aspect of the film is that I mean that like Totoro's amazing, like all of the animation's amazing, the art in the film is amazing, but like just that dynamic that the family has is like my favorite, probably my favorite thing of this. How do you why is this like one of your favorite movies ever?
I love Totoro. It's like you said, it's a feel-good movie, and this, I guess, there's something very mystical about, I guess, Studio Ghibli in general. Like when you hear animation these days, it's a certain thing you expect. Like when you watch cartoons, certain cartoons, well, depending on who's making it, like, obviously, Cartoon Network just was a station that felt like people were high on weed all the time when they were drawing the characters and making the film. But the Studio Ghibli days, this mysticism, but there's always some beautiful nature you're in, and you're just like, I want to be there. You know, there's always this environmental aspect of Ghibli films in it, even with Totoro, in sense of like a respecting of the land they're in, a respecting of the creatures that they do not even understand. Like, for example, when they first see those bunny, like dust bunnies looking things, there is like, obviously there's the fear of it, but there's also the excitement of it, but it's not like obviously exploiting it, you know, or you know, killing it.
It's like every like natural thing, even like the grass, like a sort of given like an importance, right, that we give to like human characters. I don't know, there's probably a word for that, but that's a very good point, is that everything sort of feels like it's equally important in the film, you know. It's not like, oh, there's the grass over there, no, that's like the like important, like it's crucial to the environment and everything. And I mean that, like, there is definitely like an environmental aspect to it, because one of the things I love about this film too, like going sort of connected to the family too, is that in a sort of, if this movie were made today, I think you would see that the kids would have all of these experiences with the spirits or whatever, I guess whatever they are really. And in a typical film today, the parents would probably be like, that doesn't exist. Yeah. You don't know what you're talking about. You're just a kid. And it would sort of be like this, you know, like an unhealthy sort of relationship, right? But I love that this film, the dad is like, it's such a great thing that you got to experience this, that you got to see this spirit, right?
Yeah.
And he takes, there's a really great scene where he takes his daughters to like this tree, and he's like, you know, the nature and or humans and the rest of nature used to have like this really close bond that they're not and that they don't have that bond anymore. And so I mean there's definitely that nature aspect to the film.
Yeah, I agree with you. The whole idea of like, oh, you have an imaginary friend, just imaginary, but in a sense the father wasn't playing to that, like you said, if the film was made if the film was made in America, that's like, kind of like to be wonky, I feel like even if the film was made in America and was made in 1988, you'll still have that same undertone of like, you're just imagining things, you know. Even when the older daughter was even like trying to be like, oh, that does not exist, I can't see him, you know, we can't see it. But then he knows the younger daughter or something, so he's still, you know, playing into not discrediting what she saw, all those kind of things. And I just, like you said, every theme has a role. I remember, like, when, I think one of the key roles was the tree that was growing, that grew so fast.
I'm glad you're talking about that.
When you talk about everything, please, and that was, like, one of the crucial roles, crucial points in the film. And, like, the thing is, like, you talk about, like, family, and you remember, like, the mother is not well. And even though it's something playing along in the film, because it still is one of the main storylines that the mother is not well, and so the father has to take care of the daughters, and all this are happening, and even at dad, when he doesn't have the time to take care of the daughters, yeah, this nature, more or less, is protecting them. Because I remember one time they were trying to give their father the umbrella or something like that, and then, like, that's when Totoro comes with some cats. Taxi. And, like, everything, like you said, plays a role in that. And I... Like, this made this... Oh, well...
No, go ahead, yeah.
No, like, the sadness of, like, the mother being in the hospital and, like... But you don't feel sad in the whole film. Do you get what I'm saying? It's like, there's the main key point is that the mother is in the hospital, and these girls are having to deal with, like, a single father at the point right now. But there's, like, no sadness. It just feels like not just them as a family unit, because the old lady who lives right across the street is helping them. And then the one guy who is weird and, like, goes to the girls' school, the older sisters, who is also a neighbor to them, who acts very weird. I remember when she was asking for an umbrella and they gave her an umbrella. Everyone is, like, the whole, the environment, the neighbors, everyone is a family unit. So it's not just the father, mother, and, like, the daughters. But what do you have to say?
Oh, like, just to my, like, film critic brain, I was like, what does the cat bus mean? What does it all mean? That was so confusing to me. But, yeah, it's, I mean, I'm still, like, trying to figure out what that means. But, yeah, because, like, someone who, like, tries to dissect films, right? Like, that's, like, it's, like, the film just telling you, like, or giving you, like, challenging you, right, to, like, think about that but stuff. But, yeah, I'm really glad you brought up for context, they're trying to plant seeds, right? Mm-hmm. Or they're trying to grow food, or I guess plants or food. I don't remember which one it is, but they plant seeds, right? And it's not growing, and then that's when Totoro comes in and he helps it grow. And I think they do like a dance or something.
Yeah, they do a dance.
Yeah, so like it's like the ceremonial thing, and so it's just probably meaning to that, right? Like the fact that you're doing this like ancient ritual, right? Yeah. To make the thing grow. But of course you get this like amazing thing where this huge tree grows, and I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that, so like there's a, I think the creator of the Miyazaki wanted this to be like basically like an alternate history of Japan, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I couldn't help but like notice, like when you look at the cloud, right, like it looks like, and this is gonna sound kind of crazy, right, but it looks like a nuclear explosion. Like it looks like, if you look at it, there's like certain like clips of it where it looks like a mushroom cloud like erupting out of a nuclear blast, right? Mm-hmm. How's that related to the utopian alternative history? Well, it's like, it's almost like the nuclear thing didn't happen in this timeline, right?
Yeah.
And so it's, I don't know, like maybe that's evidence of it, right? Is that like that sort of takes a different expression in this history, right? It's like you don't have that, like that happened here, but it's instead of, it's like a utopian future, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think it's far off, because like 5 years previous to my neighbor Totoro, Ghibli released The Grave of Fireflies, which, oh my god, that film was so sad, but it was mostly focused on the war and mostly focused on family, the siblings, more or less trying to survive the ruins of the war. And so I don't think you are far off, because I think even Ghibli, there's a lot of references to that, even using the mysticism of weird characters. And going back to the cat taxi, which you do not understand, I don't understand it either. But then, like, the thing is that I go into Ghibli movies hoping not to understand very weird things. There's this Howl's Moving Castle, which is another Ghibli film, has a weird, mm-hmm. it talks about, in a sense, sorcery and witchcraft. And then there mm-hmm. are like the house moving, and like a lot of things that happen. There's this, the scarecrow, not scarecrow, but like the pole, there's a pole scarecrow looking thing that hops about, mm-hmm. and it is a scarecrow, I just realized. It's a scarecrow, and it hops on the stand by itself. And I'm just like, what purpose? Because the scarecrow, at first, you're just like, is it here to help or is it here not to help? There are like weird mysticisms that are in Ghibli that, I mean, if you go, like, even I go and dissect films, I go into Ghibli hoping not to dissect shit, because I'm just like, it's like the mysticism is a lot, and it's amazing. It puts the child story mm-hmm. together, to be honest, because at the end of the day, the cat taxis, the reason they were able to get to your mother early, and all those kind of things. But like, I do believe that you are not far off when it comes to talking about the war. I feel like Ghibli Studio, like 1988 to 1990s, was mostly focused on using their films to, like you said, not rewrite, but like present Japan's perspective of the war. But not really making it very glaring that, oh, this is what we're talking about. So there are hints and pieces here.
Yeah.
And there.
And one of the reasons I bring it up too is because of the history too. Like, if you look at, and I just double checked, but Another film that was made in in Japan and is takes place in Japan is Akira, which is like one of my favorite films of all time, I think. It's so and it came out the same year, I believe, 1988. And that film is all about, I mean, not all of it, but it's about like dealing with the fact like nuclear warfare, right? And like thinking about what that means about like humans, and like posing philosophical questions about like why humans, should humans have that power, to with with the use of science to construct basically like doomsday weapons, right? And so there's that whole, but and so like that obviously affected the cinema of Japan, right? And so I just can't help but like compare the two, like of them sort of, I mean obviously Akira deals with it far more explicitly, but it's just interesting to think about how like Totoro is also like a part of that like conversation, I guess, for them.
I don't. I'm going into like it's fine. I love Akira too. I love that film. But I'm going to like a weird zone where like, cause I as we were talking, I was just thinking because like you said, Akira and Totoro came out the same year, and there might have been a theme previously about the whole, presenting the nuclear warfare, in films, Japanese films, but I just thought of it in a sense of like Totoro. Like the oddity of Totoro, and like obviously you're talking about the movement of the grass, the tree growing fast, the mother being sick. It could all be, this is just a theory. It could all be consequences of something as an atomic bomb or a nuclear warfare happening at a time where alterations of nature is happening, and something like the cataxy might
That's a
make
wild theory,
sense.
yeah. Yeah.
Please, I'm just I am going into a weird zone. But that is a theory. I'm throwing it out there. It doesn't make sense if you put
Well,
everything together.
I mean, it's not
But
that far off because, like, if we're talking, like, if I know it's probably unfair to compare the two, but like, yeah, Akira and in Akira, you have like the fact that there are these I mean, there's literally like a third world war in a nuclear war that happens, and that decimates Tokyo, and that's why you have Neo Tokyo in the film. But as part of that, you have these like experiments happening with kids, and so they get like these telekinesis powers, right? And so that's the explanation, right? And but and like in Totoro, right, like they're not these sort of like different like almost fantastical, not even more like scientific science fiction, but like almost fantastical things that happen is like the people who whenever they talk about Akira, right, like the actual character in Akira that's called that, they sort of talk about it like in terms of like enlightenment and like reaching a higher state of being, and so it's interesting to think about like how those things, how like the consequences of nuclear warfare could like have these, I guess, just positive things come out of it. I don't know. I wouldn't, maybe not, maybe positive is not the right word, but I don't know. It's like a rabbit hole we've gone down with this, but it is an interesting question, just thinking about like the history of Japan and like how that affected their cinema. What's, I mean, and you're right, like just to go back to the we didn't really, we haven't really talked about like art or like the art that goes into it, but you pause that film in every enemy part, and it's like a painting that you could put up on the wall, like it's I really miss that style of filmmaking, and it's one of the reasons I love Akira too, like because that it's sort of in that same artistic like where they were literally hand drawing it as they were making the movie.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I like went on the binge, the Studio Ghibli binge, because like all the films are so beautiful. The Like you said, pause it and it feels like a pain. I will still go back to even something that's weird as Howl's Moving Castle that deals with witchcraft, and sorcery and etc. They are like the so much beautiful sceneries in certain places, and I'm just
There's also a really good on if you have HBO Max, I discovered this, and it's like this just genius thing that someone made. It's It's basically all of like a lot of just nature shots of all of Studio Ghibli's
Yeah,
films,
I've
and
seen it.
they you've seen that?
Yeah.
They com okay, so they compile them, right? And they put like just this most like tranquil music behind it, and it's the best thing ever. It's like, yeah, I love that.
And the fact that going to music, weirdly, Studio Ghibli music songs. Why the music? with S. Studio Ghibli songs are like the theme of tranquility. Is even like in Totoro, the soundtrack, the score is just so calm. And I guess that's something that also plays to the whole idea of like even when it seems like there is a like intense narrative situation with the mother, we don't exactly feel it. I don't know if I'm the only one, but I do not feel that, you know, intense tension when it comes to the mother. I know it's urgent because I'm like, oh, the mother didn't come back, but she will. There's also this weird optimism, like, oh, she will, nothing will happen to her. But everything
Yeah,
about it is calming.
it's interesting thinking of like narratively of that film of like, okay, where's the sort of dramatic question, right? Like, 'cause like in so just for as an example, like in Avengers, right? Like the dramatic question is, are they going to defeat the big bad guy, right? But in this film, it's sort of like, it's not really like, is the mother going to survive? It's more like, and which sort of causes the tension in the film. It's more of, you know, are the how is the family gonna respond to this? Are they gonna respond to it like in a positive or health or unhealthy way, like something like that? Like, because yeah, it's never, I feel like the sort of the drama of it isn't the mother's illness itself, it's how the family reacts to it. And because we didn't really talk about this, but like the dynamic between the daughters, right? Like one's obviously trying to fill like the role of the mother, and you have the younger one trying to be as strong as she can. I feel like the drama's more there, where you hope that they're gonna make it out, you know, like as a family.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and I think that is. I don't know why the film is so moving in a sense. Not moving, but I do feel like obviously the mother's illness plays a role, but it's like you said, the reaction to the mother's illness that is the, you know, when the sister gets lost, and the whole idea of like, oh, is she in the hospital? We need to go to hospital or something like that. And like you feel that's when there's a huge tension, like, oh my God, where is she? Where is she, little girl?
That last part I will say is like nerve-wracking.
Yeah,
That
it is.
'cause the film is so brilliant that it doesn't, like, if it wanted to reassure you, it would show you like her in the hospital while they're out looking for her, right? Or they're looking for the dad, right? But the film doesn't, and it sort of puts you in the perspective of the kids, and so you're like worried as they are, right?
Actually, like, I think, was it they saw someone in the water and they brought the child out and just I was like, oh my God, it might be the girl. Oh no, I hope she didn't die or something like that. But then it wasn't. And
That is the worst feeling ever. I don't like if you have siblings, like for whoever's listening to the podcast, like if you have siblings, you've probably had an experience where younger siblings specifically, where you lose, or you don't lose one of them, but you just feel like you have a moment, I think, when you feel like, oh God, they're in danger or something like that. Like, I feel like that's like either you sort of lose sight of them or something, or you just, it's something as simple as like, they're not at the house, but you hear like an ambulance and you think that like something's happened to them, like that sort of feeling that you have. Like it really like, that's when I say like it really feels like a real family, like even though it's but it's Studio Ghibli, right? But so it like really makes you feel like that dynamic that you have as a family.
Yeah, I have siblings and I'm the oldest, so I truly understand that in a lot of senses, in which like for example, I come back to the house and it's quiet. I'm like, okay, yeah, it's supposed to be quiet, but then I open every door and make sure like where are they? I hope they're in the right place. But yeah, that moment of panic is definitely something very prominent among siblings. Even siblings that do not like each other. I'm guessing. I'm talking to certain people in the podcast. But I remember like one of my classes where we talked about world cinema and we talked about presentations, and this group had to present on Studio Ghibli, and someone was like trying to compare Studio Ghibli to Disney and saying like the fact that Studio Ghibli has intense realism compared to like Disney. Like for example, the way the kids tie their shoes, the way they run is so childlike. Like it's like so real in that sense. Those little things, they pay attention to it. And I think in a sense, because Studio Ghibli films, it takes a while for them to produce something, bring out something. You know, they have a lot of films in their catalogs, but it's not as much as Disney, because Disney is more focused on like commercialism. But Studio Ghibli is more or less focused on like the art of animation, the art of presenting a story. And I think that kind of differentiates both of them together, to be honest. And I look at the little things that they do, like when the kids tie their shoes. It's weird. It's interesting, but like when kids tie their shoes, I remember when they first ran to the house and the way they were running, I was like, it's so beautiful. There's intense attention paid to human movement that is translated to the film itself. But yeah.
Yeah, even when they're like still, right? Like there's like even when a character's just like asleep, right? Or when they're they're waking up or something, like it just feels like the way that they're like, it doesn't show you like their body, right? But just because of the way that it's drawn, it feels real. Like it leaves your imagination up to it in a way, like a little bit. But yeah, I think I agree with that. It's awkward, right? Like sometimes too, like the way they're drawn, and especially in this film because of of Maya, I think is her name, the smallest one, and yeah, like just the movement is playful, right? And just like a real kid, you know.
Yeah. So yeah, that is the end. If you have any other thing to say, you can add it. If you don't, that is the end of the discussion right now. We'll come back for part two, definitely, because we actually had the longer
list. We have to do part two, yeah.
We have to do part two, because I really do want to talk about men. It's weird.
Man, I need to talk about the last scene of men with you really bad.
that was film. Oh my god. Okay, but if you guys are wondering what we're talking about, come back for part two. Which will be filmed in future sometime. But thank you so much, Marco, for being here. And I don't know, what do you have anything to say to the audience?
No, thanks for having me. It was a blast. I hope people enjoyed it.
I hope you guys enjoyed it. So have a great day, have a great weekend, and goodbye.